Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Ikke det? Nei. Nei, men da holder vi det enkelt og gir oss her, fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken. Superenkelt regnskap.
Hvorfor skal man bruke mester? Du har jo utdannet, du har jo giddet å ta deg brye med å gå skoletida. Både det faglige, økonomi, drift, ledelse, alt som hører med, som du lærer om på mesterutdannelsen. Jeg sier jo med stolthet at jeg byggmester.
Finn din mester blant 70 håndverksfag på mesterbrev.no. Da du i trygge hender.
Denne uken det Crazy Week hos Domino's Pizza. Det betyr halv pris på all pizza til og med søndag. Pepperoni, skinke, kylling eller ostepizza. Alle favorittene til halv pris. Bestill på dominos.no eller i appen.
Du lytter til Ukraina-podden fra Nettavisen. Jeg heter Anders Lone Fosse, og jeg journalist i Nettavisen.
Jeg heter Jørgen Henriksen. Jeg Ukraina-skribent i Nettavisen og leder av Norsk-Ukrainske Venneforening.
Det 754 dager siden Russland gikk til en fullskala invasjon av Ukraina, og dermed eskalerte krigen som har vært siden 2014. I dag så har vi besøk av to personer, Jørn. Vi tar, siden vi først på det norske, så tar vi deg først igjen. Direktør i Norsk Sjømannsforbund med ansvar for politikk og myndighetskontakt. Stian Grøtte, velkommen til deg.
Det stemmer. Takk skal du ha. Emnet har modernisert oss litt, så nå jeg leder for politikk og myndighetskontakt, og det føles enda bedre.
Takk. Fra direktør til leder?
Ja, det føles mer moderne.
Takk. Den god. Og du har også besøk, som du har tatt med deg videre inn til studiet her i, hos oss. Oleg Grigoriuk. Perfect. I got the thumbs up. You are chairman of the Marine Transport Workers Trade Union of Ukraine.
Correct.
Which is, it's kind of like Stian, but
our fraternal organization from Ukraine and Norway. Yeah, that's
Ukrainian
sister
answer.
Or brother organization.
Sisters and brothers. Yeah, of course.
You were elected as the chairman May 2021.
That's great.
Correct.
That's correct.
This is we always talk about the in this podcast that the war has the war begun in 2014. How was the situation when you started in May 2021 and what changed February 2022?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the war has actually started in Ukraine in 2014. And actually, we were one of those who had a direct damage from that. Because in as far as you remember, the 2nd of May 2014, the rebellions got into the Union Building in Odessa, in my native town, and bombed and just set on fire the office, our union office, our home. So we lost the office in Odessa, and 2 months, if I'm not mistaken, before, the same happened to the Union Building in Kiev, which we had the representative office as well. So within those tragic events, we've lost both our homes. So at that particular moment, we were homeless and we were meeting the war in very, very pathetic circumstances. And, you know, our condition of the union was very poor. But again, thanks to the union solidarity, the worldwide supported us so much. And we managed to buy and build the union office. So now we have the union home in Odessa. And we started the response to the challenges of the war since the very beginning, helping our army, building up relationship with the Navy. And we continue to do so till now. We're helping a lot, involving ourselves into any humanitarian needs they might have, as well as for our members.
Yeah, that fire in Odessa, that's really something that's it's still a part of sort of the information warfare around the war. Were you present? Did you have people from your union that were hurt in the fire?
Yeah, thanks to Lord, it was like the May holiday, so that none of our workers were at the workplace at that moment. So no one got injured, but, you know, we lost all the equipment. Yeah. All the paperwork was almost gone. So it was a quite difficult time for the union. But we reestablished quite quickly, renting premises in Odessa. And after a week time, we already continued to support our members.
But at this time, Russia had already moved in and occupied the Crimean Peninsula. How did that affect you? Did you lose a lot of members or infrastructure and things during that occupation?
Yeah, in fact, so far that's the biggest loss we experience, because in Crimea we used to have around 7 union local organizations in the ports of Kerch, Eupatoria, Sevastopol, what's the other one? I forgot already. So it's like 5 or 7 organizations we used to have, Kerch. So there was a big infrastructural Crimean organizations for us, and thousands of members we used to organize. And unfortunately, straight after that, we lost any contacts with them. And we've learned that a lot of our union leaders turned to the Russian side, which was really, really disappointing. And yeah, that was really that was even worse expectation for us, that our comrades, we considered comrades, they became more pro-Russian, and now we treat them obviously as the traitors.
Yeah, and some of them that maybe were neutral or even pro-Ukrainian, there's a chance that they have been forcefully mobilized and have actually been forced to go to war against Ukraine.
That could be the case. That could be the case.
Did they work side by side, Ukrainians and Russians, before? And how is it now?
What do you mean? I'm not getting.
On ships, for
example. Oh, you mean on the vessels? Yeah, yeah. On the other side, we used to have a big number of Ukrainian seafarers who were at that time residing in Crimea, and we were treating them absolutely the same as the Ukrainians, obviously, and we were considering them, and that's why we had a lot of international arguments at that time with the Seafarers Union of Russia, saying that this is our members, and they should be treated and they should be considered as our members whatsoever, because your government or your country just invaded it or annexed it in a way, you say. So it's like totally unacceptable, and we had a lot of arguments on that time, but obviously due to the political and other situation and economical situation at that particular time, we couldn't do anything about it. But the statement was very clear. We say, if this is Ukrainian seafarer using the Ukrainian competency documents, using the Ukrainian passport, we're going to treat them as the Ukrainian seafarer. So he can easily apply to the union for any sort of support.
How many Ukrainian seafarers are there globally today?
The figure is not actually clear, okay. But we consider around 100,000 Ukrainian seafarers, and almost half of it is our union members. So we have quite massive membership. Yeah.
That's a massive seafaring nation then.
Oh, it's really big. We are always on the third, fourth place in the world after Filipinos, Indians, and Chinese. So we are the largest on the European flag vessels.
Yeah,
that's in terms of the officers, obviously.
But there are a lot of Russian seafarers as well, and also Norwegian ships. How did they handle the situation when? Of course, there's been tension ever since 2014, but when the full-scale invasion happened, there must have been a lot of tensions on the ships. How did they handle their co-workers being stuck on a ship?
This is one of the most popular questions, obviously, asked to me throughout the full-scale invasion. For me, it's still very, very surprising that the level of professionalism shown by Ukrainian seafarers is so high that we didn't experience that many cases of tension or, you know, open aggression against the Russian seafarers, which is still very surprising to me. But again, it proves that Ukrainian seafarers are highly professional and smart and brave enough not to, you know, spill it out and not to be a part of provocations, which I believe there was many of them on board the ships. So I'm proud of them that they are, you know, keeping the professional distance and not focus on that. And I'm really grateful to the partner companies who are trying to, you know, to set up sort of the policy which says that there is no political discussion on board the ship. We're here to do the job, and let's not discuss. When you will be out aboard the ship, you can do whatever you want, but when we are in your political position, I believe that majority of Ukrainians have the only position, but on board the ship, it should be keeping really professional, and I know how extremely difficult it is to keep it up like that.
Yeah, because Stian, I guess that you have members that has experienced this, that they were working on ships where they have both Ukrainian and Russian colleagues, and suddenly they are engulfed in a full-scale war from one day to the next. Do you have any feedback from your members on how they have experienced this situation?
I think what Oleg described is quite correct, actually. And seafarers are very professional, and you know, in every boat has to almost like their own community, their own society. And I don't have, to my reckon, it's not so many incidents. So I think that says a lot about the professionality of all seafarers, regardless of nationality. But so I think all the describe it's quite correct. Yes.
We've been talking on this podcast about the attacks on the Russian Black Sea fleet. Especially during the last year, there's been many military Russian ships which have been sunk. Is this something that affects the Ukrainian seafarers? Has it become more safe in the Black Sea for Ukrainian seafarers, or is there no transportation there almost at all?
I believe that it worth mentioning that, or get back to the history a little bit, when you remember that for the very beginning there was no shipping at all.
So we understand. In the beginning, you are talking 2014 or 2020?
No, I'm not full scale. I'm talking about the full scale. At that time, before that time, the shipping was booming, and the exports were booming. Everything was working quite well. But before the full scale, after the full scale, obviously everything stopped. The equatorium was heavily mined with the sea mines, so there was extreme danger to go into that, and it's prohibited from Ukrainian government to do any sort of practices in equatorium of the Black Sea, and obviously it was, and all the logistics moved from the ports of Big Odessa, from Nikolai, from Kherson, it went to Izmail, to the Danube region, and it's still quite, and it actually affected in a very positive way the ports of Izmail and Reni, which are started to economically to grow, and the dock workers and the administration of the port started to, you know, the social standards, the salary standards grow up, because they had the 100% workload, and they were growing. Now the big ports, the ports of Odessa still working, and this, you remember that was established the grain corridor, which considered to be a part of the deal with Russia and guarantee of Turkey of safety measures and security and stuff. And there was a certain procedure which was affecting the whole process, and then the decision was made, you know, to continue even after Russia has withdrawn itself from this agreement. So we continued to do that, and it was the deal to do the only exports of grains to support the third countries and, you know, the developing countries, and for the food supply to have no disruptions on that. But now we are heavily considering the any other sorts of cargoes, and as actually I know that there already some sorts of cargoes already transferred and exported from the ports of Ukraine. Now we're thinking that the containers should be also be running through the Ukrainian ports. So it's getting much better in terms of the economy. So it's growing and developing. But when we talk about the safety and security of the dock workers and seafarers, this is my huge concern, because unfortunately we're not the part of those processes of negotiations, and I believe that the human factor has like third or fourth priority, unfortunately, because everyone is focused on the war affairs, about the economical impact for the country. I understand all that, but being a union leader, I have to think of our members and the human factor first, which we do. That's why, for me, it's a huge concern, because there is no security or safety insurance for those port workers, for example, who are doing this job, especially at the night shifts, because normally during the night, the Shaheds and missiles are attacking Odessa region, which, again, there is a certain procedure on the enterprises that they have to go to the bomb shelters, but, you know, the rocket is very fast, like the... Sometimes it comes before alarm or after alarm in 2 minutes. So it's hard to get out of the crane or got out of the quay to get to the bomb shelter. So all these questions are having a lot of, you know, humanitarian impact on the workers. And this is our huge concern. And we're trying to address it to the Ministry of Infrastructure or to the private companies who are running this business. On the other side, there is the Ukrainian or any other seafarers who are calling Ukrainian ports. That's another concern, because when we talk about the international standards like ITF standards, we have a certain procedure. The seafarer has the right not to go to this war operation or war-like area, war zone, and you can refuse. But for the rest of the vessels, which is the majority of those who call Ukrainian ports, we don't know what kind of social security system or collective bargaining agreement applied on board. Sometimes none of them applicable. So that's another concern for the safety and the security of the seafarers. What will happen if the missile got on the ship or hit the ship? Who's going to be responsible for the life and health of those seafarers? We had one case when the safely moored, or the vessel was coming to the port of Odessa, and the missile hit the superstructure of the Liberian flagged vessel, and Ukrainian pilot was killed by this hit. So again, my question is, who's going to be responsible for this? So there is the huge number of humanitarian issues which I believe are not addressed due to the fact that the priority is the exports, and everyone is talking about that, and human factor is always somewhere behind, which supposed to be the first one.
I think the situation of the Black Sea is very interesting, because it's something that when I am in debates here in Norway with what we internationally call peaceniks that have statements like, well, weapons never solve anything. I think the Black Sea situation is an example of where weapons have solved something, because even though Ukraine doesn't have a navy, as Anders said, they have sunk so many Russian warships with their sea-going drones that they have actually pushed them out of the Western Black Sea. And now Ukraine exports the same amount of food as they did before the full-scale invasion, which is extremely impressive. Mm-hmm. And that has been solved by weapons and not the negotiations, because the negotiations and the agreement it was very ineffective. And the Russians, like they do with any deal you do with them, were sabotaging it with very slow inspections and stuff. So now that Ukraine, with their own produced weapons, have pushed the Russians out, it actually works, and they export food. And that's hugely important for the parts of the world where they have food shortages. Yeah. But also, the next thing you said, I think it's extremely fascinating. It was something that I found fascinating when I visited Ukraine recently, is how much and to what a large degree Ukraine still functions as a working society, even though they're at war. And it's impressive to listen to you that you're here. Yeah, your country is at war, your members are at war, but at the same time, you operate at the core of your function. You look after their health and safety. Would you say that it's even extra important to unionize and be a part of a larger collective when your country is at war?
You're absolutely right. Actually, that's I believe that those, you know, enormous black swans and challenges which hit the any community or country or the world itself, like COVID, for example, right? So we just I was elected in the middle of the COVID. Can you imagine? And we were struggling, like everyone else in the world, with the restrictions, with the border crossing issue. So there were so many challenges which we were not prepared to, but we managed to adapt. And then after several months, we found out that it was just a practice for us. Now is the real challenge coming. So that's the fact. So we've learned to adapt, and we continue learning to adapt. And all these cases show that if you're all alone, without international solidarity, without internal solidarity, when seafarers and dockers were just coming to our office and were saying, okay, guys, do you need some help? We're gonna, whatever we need, whatever you need, whatever our members need, we will do it via yourself, via your welfare fund. We're ready to support you. So it's all, you can't even explain with the simple words how important it is to be organized, how important it is to be united. And I believe that this volunteers movement, which have grown excessively in Ukraine, and every city, every community has its own volunteers organization, registered or not registered, you know, it's just the emotional moment that you just need to organize and to help those who are suffering from Kakhovka blow up or from the occupied regions who are just moving from devastated Mariupol or from occupied zones in the east of the country. So all that gives us a clear understanding that the unionism itself, the unity of the people, is something extremely important. And it's getting more and more important since we're continue our struggle.
Yeah, I just have a question, because like Jørn said, I'm also very impressed by how you seem to function, the whole Ukrainian society. And the war starts in May 2014, that's a fact, but the full-scale invasion was in 22. Were you somehow prepared? Do you expect it to happen? Or could you tell us a little bit about that, Oleg?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important question, because to my understanding, that's very subjective, it's what I think. Yeah. We were not that prepared. Mm-hmm. We thought everything goes in a diplomatic, civilized way. And because Ukraine is on its whole way full ahead to Europe, we were expecting that everyone else is thinking in a way we do, like thinking about European approach, diplomacy, talks, and that kind of stuff. We didn't expect that barbarian aggression to spell out again. Me personally, till the very last moment, I couldn't even imagine that this can actually happen. So, yeah, that we were, to my understanding, we were not that yet that well prepared, let's put it this way. But on the other hand, I think that we mobilized ourselves quite effectively and adapted to the challenge quite effectively. That gave us an understanding that there is no way to go. We just need to protect the country, support our heroes on the front line, you know, and that's actually what we are focused on. We are just focusing on supporting those who defend the country. That's our mission as the Ukrainians, as the citizens of Ukraine. Donate funds, gatherings, whatsoever you can do, you know, just to support them. And that became one of our, you know, routines again, to support our members. That's the first priority, and the equal priority is to support the Ukrainian forces.
So when the Russians were lining up the vehicles, the tanks, and they told everyone, they told the world, this is an exercise, you believe them?
Not me personally. I was really concerned, but I believe this is again what you have mentioned. It's not, there is no room for negotiations with them. After that, they were spreading lies, and they were, come on, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was saying to the whole world, we're not gonna do that, and they just did it. My God, for Christ's sake. That's why when we talk about negotiations, with whom? With those guys who promised not to do anything and just did it? You know, it's like a 4-3. Nothing changes. The same techniques, the same methodologies, pure fascism. So for me, yeah, we wanted to believe. I think we were a bit, you know, calming ourselves, but this is the psychological trick of every, you know, clear vision mind. We don't want things, bad things to happen, and we simply couldn't believe that. And of course, as I said, being very orientated on the European values, we couldn't believe that people just could say lies to the whole world, and then the whole world gonna eat it. That's an issue.
Have you been? Have you? I wouldn't say. Have there been a lot of seafarers that have gone ashore to join the armed forces? Has that reduced your sort of membership or number of Ukrainians out at sea?
Yeah, we know that even many of our members, especially those who had the battle experience and were on board the ships when the full-scale invasion started, they just withdrawn them from board the ships and just get back home and immediately joined the armed forces. And we focused our support to supply them with helmets, bulletproof vests, or whatsoever is needed to protect themselves. So it's, we consider that around 5% of all Ukrainian seafarers joined the armed forces in one way or another, you know, being in special forces or working, being soldiers, being drafted, but working for the needs of the army as well. So it's like it's a massive, if we take 100,000, 5% is a massive involvement and massive effect.
Yeah, just, you know, you're mentioned that he's been in Ukraine not so long ago, and he had a picture on Facebook of a cemetery of the people who has fallen in this aggression. How does that affect a lot of families in Ukraine paying a very, very high price? What's going on? What does that do to this society and the everyday life in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think this is the most depressive part of any of every day what we see, you know, to bury our friends, to bury our comrades. And unfortunately, I experienced the same, because one of our classmates who we had the navigation course in the Maritime Academy, he passed away being killed. He was the battle commander. He was quite high in the special forces, and he was on the operation and he got killed. So and he was a master on board the ships, so well paid, you know. He was very, very involved himself to protect the country. I'm really proud of him, and we are continue to support his mother, and we have an article to honor his enormous efforts and his achievements in our maritime magazine, which it's called Maritime. So we do what we can, and obviously we supported him when he just joined, and we supported the family after he got killed by Russians. So this is the day-by-day tragedy, and I believe that everyone, unfortunately, has those cases to share.
Yeah. So you're here in Norway on official business and doing your sort of the core business of your trade union, and even if in a parallel universe where it was peace, then you would have still been here doing that job. But with the situation that you have now, I imagine, or my experience with any Ukrainian I meet is that, yeah, we're doing our everyday job, but every time they have an opportunity, they speak up about the need for weapon supplies to Ukraine. And that's a debate here in Norway as well that is growing now. It's been over 2 years, and there is a growing debate about, well, maybe negotiations is the solution. Any politician or person in Norway with influence on whether or not we should increase our weapons support to Ukraine, what would you like to say to them?
I want to say a lot. Listen, guys, whoever listens to me need to understand that Ukraine loses its best people, men and women who sacrificed their lives for the peace of entire world. You need to be very, very clear on understanding that this disease will come everywhere if it will not be stopped. And if we will not get the enough supply to be able to do that, this is the smallest part you can actually do, is to give everything you have to give us a chance to protect not ourselves, but yourselves. It should be very, very clear. If anyone during those debates thinks that this they will come and occupy Ukraine and they will stop, that's a big mistake. That's clearly need to be understood that these guys will never stop till the moment someone will stop them. And the only way to stop them is to get everything you all have. Norway, Lithuania, U.S., Canada, whoever. Whatever you have to supply. Don't think about the politics day after tomorrow because the war goes on now and our people die now. So we have to do it now. You have to do it now. It's not like there is no option. There is no room for debate. It's very, very clear. Not because I'm Ukrainian, but because you just, you know, it's a bloody common sense. You just need to understand it. And if you will be out of Ukrainians, who's going to do it next?
Yeah.
That's need to be clearly understood. There should be no debate, zero debate on that. You just have to, yeah, you might need to spend more cash to build up your own potential and stuff like that. But this is the reality of the world. Ukrainians didn't start that war. We didn't provoke anyone. And the whole civil world understands it. It's so clear. Whatever the propaganda of Russia says, we are the victim who stood up, don't want to be a victim. We want to protect the whole European and the whole civilized world from that disease. So just give us what you have, and we might manage to do that. That's the only option.
Yes.
Sorry to be that emotional, but that's...
Yes, and as we've discussed in many episodes on this podcast, there is a very clear and direct line from what happens in the war in Ukraine and our own security. Mm-hmm. If Ukraine falls, then the chance that Norway is at war at some point in the very near future increases a lot. And Norway has weapon systems that can increase the safety of Oleg's members that are sailing in the Black Sea. The Ukraine are hopefully very soon getting F-16s and maybe Gripens from Sweden, so they're going to have a modern air force with capabilities. The Norwegian naval strike missile is something that Ukraine has asked for and something they should be provided that would not only push the Russians out of the Western Black Sea, but make it dangerous for them to operate anywhere in the Black Sea. And that would make Oleg's members much safer. We also have taken a responsibility to build up the Ukrainian Navy with the UK. And we have some small military ships that could be useful for Ukraine, for example, the corvettes, and also... the Stridsbåt 90, which I used to sail on back in the day, but they are being phased out now in Norway. It's a Swedish-made boat that would be very useful for Ukraine. So, and also artillery grenades that we talked about. So there's a lot of things that Norway could do to both increase our own security and the members of OLEG.
Can we talk about the safety in the Black Sea just for a little bit? Because you talked a little bit about the grain corridor, which is functioning as of now. But Zelensky said in the end of February this year that without the U.S. military aid, his country would be unable to defend the Black Sea shipping corridor. How dangerous is it for Ukrainian sailors to sail in the Black Sea right now?
Will repeat again that as to my concern, maybe, you know, I'm a bit disbalanced to the humanitarian side of the issue. That's clear. But I believe that there is a huge risk. I'm not scaring anyone. But and again, this is my subjective view. It's always, you know, it's called high risk area. It's called warlike zone. It's called war area. You know, it's like when you go there, automatically the risk for your life and health is growing significantly. So all those, it's not only about the Ukrainian seafarers, it's all about those seafarers who are coming to calling these ports. So we understand that the level of security is highest, the level of risk is highest possible during the war. And that's why obviously the air defense systems, any other systems which can, you know, protect the civil vessels and the warships and the ports is prioritized, and I understand. But for the seafarers themselves, first of all, they have to get an option not to go there, and only all those conscienced and signed up for that will be ready to operate vessels in that area. That's how I see the civilized way of, you know, working it through. On the other side, I believe that there is still the pretty big argument around the, you know, the safety and security on that, but again, on the union side, let's put it this way. And of course, the sea mines are still there, and no one, like, not do the, at least to my knowledge, not doing the demining of the areas. So it's still scary to that point of view. It's not only about the Russians' attacks, but also all those mines which were established even from our side. So it's to my understanding, is quite dangerous. And I admire those people who agree to do that. And then they have to be well secured, well in terms of insurance. They have to be well paid with bonuses or everything possible, because they are doing a marvelous and very brave job.
It's for Norwegians, it's probably easy to compare this to the Second World War and the war movies with the vessels going over to Great Britain, yeah, for example. Is it comparable in your view, Stian?
Yeah, some of it I think it is, because all the time you need to be supported by what you need. It's ammunition, goods, everything in peacetime, but also in war times. And in war times, it's very crucial to get what you need, provisions and ammunition and everything. So yes, you could compare it. It's no doubt about that. So the effort that OLEG's members are doing every day in the Black Sea, it's crucial. It's crucial for Ukraine, and what's happening in Ukraine, as Jørn said, that's crucial for Norway.
And your union has, actually, you're still working on it today, 80 years after the war, but your union has worked a lot with the rights of the veterans of that war, civilians that were forced to be a part of the war. And it's a tragic part of our history that those rights still has to be fought for. So that's a sort of a parallel. I imagine that when victory is achieved and Ukraine goes back to rebuilding its country and will have massive costs and stuff, are you worried that the sort of common tragedy that you're sort of all together in the same boat now, then after victory is achieved and everyone needs money for everything, that your members that are then veterans of a war, even though they were civilians, that they will be forgotten and not helped as they should be?
Let's put it this way. You know, during these official, you know, trips I do, the part of it is obviously to talk about Ukraine and to raise the awareness and to tell truth to the audience about what's going on. And on the other side is very educational for us as well. So we see our unions, partner unions, how they overcome. They have a much bigger history than we do, and how they overcome the Second World War, how they overcome other crises. So we understand that, again, let's put it this way. First of all, we have to win the war, or to settle down somewhere in order we could establish peace. And now I believe the whole world is in the civis pax in parabellum mode. So everyone wants peace, but everyone will be ready for the war since what happened 2 years ago. So it feels like the first priority will have to definitely to stop the war, to win the war. And then we will adapt. As I said, we are adaptable to all these changes, and we will have to, as a union, as the society, we will have to adapt to that particular thing about the veterans. And we will, I believe we will be at the front line of taking care of them, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I just want to add that we will try to provide you with so much advice that we can, because you don't have to do the same mistakes as our union did after the Second World War. Because we did mistakes, the whole Norwegian society to big mistakes and unjust to the war sailors. So don't do what we do after did. So, yeah.
I think there's when I talk about in our Norwegian-Ukrainian Friendship yeah. Association and the parallels between Ukraine yeah. And Norway, I think there are three major parallels. One is that Valdemar, who Vladimir Zelensky is named after, who founded Kyiv Rus and Ukraine. There's a lot of people saying that he was from Sweden. Personally, I think he was,
he was from
Norwegian Viking. But there are links through the Vikings that traveled down the rivers and helped found the Kyiv Rus. The two other parallels is that we are both massive seafaring nations with a massive number of seafarers, and we are both agricultural nations with So that is a sort of two major groups that should have solidarity with each other. And I, for example, the union that Stian represents, but also the two other major maritime unions in Norway have a lot of solidarity with Ukraine. But on one point, I think Norway is failing as a maritime nation, and that is that we are the only country in Europe that has open harbors for Russian ships. And I took some pictures of some of the trawlers that were in Tromsø, which is one of those harbors, with their very fit seafarers, which is a dig at that they're not only landing fish in Tromsø, they're also landing intelligence operatives. And that core here in Norway has documented that these ships are very important to land Russian agents in Norway. But one of the major problems with this is the one of the latest developments in the war now is that Ukraine is using drones to hit oil facilities in most of Russia, even 900 kilometers from Ukraine, and that is to reduce the war economy of Russia, and it's a very important job because the Russians are running at the deficit, so their economy is shrinking, and oil exports is very important for them to keep going. So each hit on an oil refinery is damaging the Russian economy. Then it's very depressing that Norway is sort of helping the Russian economy with buying Russian fish from Russian boats. And we did up the Norwegian-Ukrainian Friendship Association, commissioned a poll in 2022 that showed that 88% of the Norwegian people wants to completely close the Norwegian harbors for Russian ships. And actually the region of Norway that had the highest percentage in this poll was the northern counties, which is actually the ones that would hurt the most financially from this closing. So the people up north, they have solidarity with Ukraine, even though it would hurt them financially. So this is a black spot on our politics. And I don't know if you were aware about these harbors from before, but the fact that we put money into the Russian war economy. What is your message to the Norwegian government regarding these harbors?
Yeah, I didn't know exactly that this is happening in the ports of Norway, but unfortunately the disgraceful fact that this happens worldwide, it, you know, turns us a lot down, especially those countries who could afford avoiding this and declaring that no Russian ships are welcome, because back to the 2022, there were some ports and harbors who rejected all the Russian-related vessels, and they were sanctioned heavily, which I believe is a very good economical effect. Not a very good economical effect for those countries, but it is the real disruption for Russia, which is a benefit for Ukraine and our future victory. So obviously my message will be, if you can afford it, then you have to do it. If you can't, but I believe that you can afford it. Yep. In terms of Norway, you can afford it, or you can use your facilities for something similar or even better. Just do a better logistics, and that's it. I believe that's the message to all those developed countries who can afford to avoid Russian oil, you know, and not invest in the Russian economy. That's why actually in 2022 we were highlighting to our partners worldwide that they don't have to hire Russian seafarers, that they can hire Ukrainians instead, and it will give a positive economical effect for Ukraine, which will give us additional resources to fight back and to defend ourselves. And on the other side, all those Russian seafarers will not bring these monies to the Russian Federation and will not input it into the Russian economy, where we are saying they're building tanks and building drones or whatever they built to kill Ukrainian civilians. So that's, for me, as being Ukrainian, it's the absolutely logical way of thinking. I understand that there are more economical background on that, or any even more political background on that. But I believe that this is what every civilized country or developed country which can afford it should do, shall do.
And real solidarity sometimes costs you something.
Exactly.
Has the Norwegian Sjømannsforbund taken a stance in this political issue?
No, we have not. But and this is, conflict, lots of conflicts, but if you ask me personally, I would say that, just remind everybody that Oleg said earlier in this podcast, Ukrainian families are paying with their losses of their sons, their kids, their relatives, friends. They're paying with the ultimate price every day. And I think that could give some perspective on this harbor debate.
Yeah, the people nothing to take to compare with the financial, with the financial side of the issue. That's for sure.
Stian Grøtte, Oleg Grigorjuk, once again nailed it. Thank you so much for visiting the podcast. You have appointments throughout the day, so we have to let you go now. But
my pleasure, and Slava Ukraini.
Herom Slava.
Det enkelt nok for kundene dine å betale? Med betalingsløsninger fra Svea kan du tilby samme fleksible løsning på nett og I fysisk butikk. Svea. Vår jobb. Din betalingsløsning. Enklere. Raskere.
Kiwi-kunder kan spare tusenvis med Kiwi Plus. Du får 50% tromsbonus på hver eneste pakke bleie, bind og tamponger. I tillegg får du 15% bonus på all fersk frukt og grønt, og 1% på alt det andre. Det blir det fort penger av. Last ned appen vår og bruk bonusen I butikk, eller overfør til bankkonto og bruk på hva du vil. Vær smart du også, og gjør som over 2,2 millioner andre. Bli Kiwi Plus-kunde du også.